Hello, everybody. Welcome to the dungeon, my pets. I am your hostess or your mistress, whichever one you prefer, Danae Dunning. And I would like for you to welcome my co-host, Carl Kafer. Say hello.
Or shall
Carl.
I say slave? I am your slave mistress.
Say hello to everybody, Carl.
Hello to everybody, Carl.
Folks, he's also a smart aleck, but that's one of the many reasons why I love him. How are you doing tonight, Carl?
I'm doing okay. Doing okay. Nice, quiet day. Nothing much going on. It's a good thing.
Well,
so this
folks,
is going to be fun.
Huh?
This is going to be fun.
Yes, it is. We are having a fun topic tonight. We are talking about franchise fatigue. How a movie series can go on and on and on with repeating the same storyline and having the quality dip.
Mm-hmm.
Also, but before we get into this, I have to get something off my chest. I'm sure a lot of you have probably heard about the controversial French film Mignons, or in English, Cuties. It debuted on Netflix the 9th. There was controversy about it even before it landed because of the marketing campaign. Basically, what it's about is an 11-year-old girl named Ami tries to rebel against her strict Muslim upbringing by joining a dance troupe. That sounds innocent enough, yes. However, the dance troupe, totally fine and innocent until they start twerking to win a competition. And these girls, they're 11 years old. Now, they don't have older actresses, young-looking 18-year-olds playing 11-year-olds. These are actually 10, 11-year-old girls wearing skimpy clothing, bumping and grinding, sucking on their fingers, doing all sorts of disgusting stuff. Now, I watched the movie because there was something that came out that said that Netflix mismanaged the marketing, and that's really not how it was portrayed. Oh, it's much worse than how. It's much worse. Much worse.
I read that article, by the way, and I was wondering what your reaction to that would be, and once you watched it. So tell us about it.
Well, it starts out innocently enough. Ami is a Senegalese 11-year-old Senegalese girl who moves with her mother and her little brother and her infant sibling. They never say what the gender of the baby is. So anyway, she moves with her mother and her two siblings. Her father is still in Senegal, and there's tension and sadness in the home because he's preparing to bring home a second wife. So, yeah, there's already tension, and as far as a strict Muslim upbringing, it doesn't really seem that strict. I mean, the only thing is that they wear hijabs when they're out in public, and they're seen at a prayer meeting. And it seems like, other than the father coming home with another wife, it seems like that they're pretty okay. I mean, did they have a loving dynamic between each other? But she meets these girls that bully her, and she wants to impress them. She sees them dancing, and she wants to join the troupe. Well, everything's all fine and dandy. The dance moves are innocent enough until they watch a twerking video, and they decide to copy it because their competitors are these older girls who do this. So they figure that they can get a leg up if they start dressing skimpy and doing these suggestive moves. I tell you what, I felt like a creepo watching this. Even though I was not turned on at all by it, I still felt like a creepo. I felt like I needed a bath after watching this movie.
Wow.
And the director said that it was based on her own experiences and the experience of young girls she's talked to. And she says that the movie is against the sexual exploitation of children. But here's the thing. I have watched movies both on TV and made for cable and theatrical that dealt with the subject of child prostitution, child porn, that did it in a non, you know, that was against it, but did it in a non-exploitive manner. It can be done. It seems to me that she is just using this as an excuse. And another thing that bothers me is that there are a lot of critics and a lot of Hollywood actors that are actually championing the film, and they're saying that anyone who is against it are basically prudes.
Lovely.
Yeah. And they even won a prize at Sundance.
Well, I can't say much. I can't say much because I've not seen it. I just know that there's a lot of controversy around it. That's all I know.
Well, the controversy is earned, you know. And, you know, some people could call me a prude, but, I mean, if I were a prude, I wouldn't even be doing this show. Trust me, with the stuff that we have covered on this show, but, you know, I draw the line when it comes to kids. You don't mess with kids. You don't sexualize kids. And if you are against that, then you can portray it in a non-exploitive manner.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
In fact, even there's hashtag cancel Netflix going on. Now, I'm not going to cancel my Netflix. I do hope that they remove it. There have been some people petitioning for it to be removed. And I'm not for cancel culture, really. But if they bring any more stuff like this in, I might have to cancel my Netflix. I mean, I don't know. I'm going to see how it goes. I'm not big on cancel culture, but like I said, I draw the line at children.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that.
Okay, everybody, I got that off my chest. Now, let's get into the topic. Franchise fatigue. You know how it goes. Okay, and I understand. You know, I've done the franchise thing before. I think I have not seen every single Friday the 13th movie, but I've seen most of them. You know, they get to a while where I got tired of franchises. Now, if it goes past the third movie, even if I really like it, I'm not interested because I'm always afraid that I'm going to get disappointed.
Yeah, I can see that. I can absolutely see that. I mean, there's so many of the films out there from franchises that once you get past a certain point, it's just a rehash, or it just goes off the rails, or there's no continuity from the other films, or whatever the case would be.
Mhm. And the quality goes down.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
No, we didn't.
So what?
Huh?
Okay, I was just going to say particular franchise do you think really exemplifies your point?
Friday the 13th, I'm going to start with that one, and I think a lot of people have issues with this. Okay, first it starts out. It was never supposed to be a franchise, and I got to warn people, I'm going to be talking about spoilers here, so listen at your own risk. And of course, most everybody knows, even people who haven't seen it, know that in the first movie, Jason was dead. He drowned when he was a child. And it caused a psychotic break in his mother. So she feels like she has to punish all camp counselors, even though the one she killed in the first movie had nothing to do with it and probably weren't even born or were just small children when her son died. But, you know, she had a psychotic break, lost her only kid, and so she, you know, when they opened the camp back up, she started killing again. Jason was never supposed to be the killer. He came back in a dream sequence at the end of the first movie, and that was it. But the movie was so popular that they decided to bring him back somehow, and apparently he wasn't dead. He's been living in the forest all this time, grown up, and he starts killing camp counselors. Okay? The third and fourth movie, he wasn't killing camp counselors, but he was killing teenagers who were living nearby the camp, but it's still leather, rinse, repeat. The fifth one, okay, he finally gets killed in the fourth one, although he got killed in the third one, too. Fourth one, okay, he starts his killing spree again, but then we find out it's not him, it's someone who's not imitating, it's someone imitating them. So then we think, okay, it's done, but no, then they bring the real Jason back. Leather, rinse, repeat. They tried something new in Jason, in the ninth one, Jason Goes to Hell. They tried something new, and they had, like, this worm-like, this worm-like thing contained his spirit, and it would jump from body to body, okay? Well, they finally vanquished him for good. So he thought, then they send him into space. And then they bring him back and have him tackle Freddy. And we haven't heard of it since, and we keep hearing that there's going to be a reboot, except it's tied up and lawsuits and things like that. So, but, you know, I saw the remake. The remake was good. It tried something a little different. But to be honest with you, I'll be perfectly happy if I never see another Friday the 13th movie ever again. I mean, I do revisit the older ones every so often, but if we don't get a new one, I'll be fine. I really will.
And so will I. I have to admit that Friday the 13th is one of my least favorite of the slashers, and I could care less about any of the sequels. I never cared for it. So to be honest, I've only seen the first one. I have seen bits and pieces of the other films, but nothing in total, nor do I care to. So that's me.
So, is there a franchise that you would like to talk about?
Well, there's a number of them. I think one of the things we want to do here in terms is take a look at maybe a franchise that actually tried to do something different throughout the films. And there have been five films in The Exorcist series. Of course, the first one in 1973 was a game changer. Seriously, it just changed everything. And I think it's a really good film, particularly of its time. But then you get into number two, okay, which is considered probably the most problematic. But that one, Linda Blair did not want to go back into the extensive makeup. John Borman, who had just come from Deliverance, decided to go in a completely different direction, which he did. And Richard Burton came on to take over the priestly duties. And there's like four different cuts of that film. And I have seen three of them. And actually, the third cut that I've seen is actually pretty decent. And of course, there's a thing where the studios really control that series, and if they don't like it, they're going to redo it, and that's the problem with the series. Three is just a fantastic film. Okay, now three, they added on The Father Mourning. They also added the original actor, Father Karras, Jason Miller. Thank you very much. And I've seen both cuts of that. I actually prefer the original cut, the theatrical cut to it, actually. And I really think, well, that particular movie was written and directed by William Peter Blatty, who did the original novel. And I thought I think that's one of the greatest sequels I've ever seen. And I love that. It has probably the best double scare jump ever in film, seriously.
I know which one you're talking about. Yes, definitely. Even though I've seen it like three or four times, that scene gets me every single time. Just like the spider walk in the original.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an amazing, amazing film. And George C. Scott is just fucking amazing in that movie. He really is. He's so good. Then you have the debacle of Dominion and The Beginning. So Paul Schrader came up with an idea, wrote the script, and did Dominion. And he did it as a very, very dissection of Catholicism and belief, and also that Father Marin, now played by Skarsgård, is basically a Western hero. And they looked at this like, what is that? And so they brought on Rennie Harlan to take the same cast and redo the complete movie again. And that one is called Exorcist: The Beginning. And Rennie Harlan tells a story where he goes to them and he's like, why do you want to do this? You have a good film here, a really good film. Somebody, you know, well, we don't like it, so we want you to do it. And he says he walked out of that. He agreed to it and walked out of that meeting knowing that he was screwed. Seriously. That there was nothing he could do. You know, and that they would do it no matter what. So he tried to do the best he can under the circumstances, but he knew it was a failure. So the Exorcist 5, The Beginning, I dislike. I mean, I give Rennie Harlan some credit, but Dominion, I think, is a really good film.
I prefer Dominion also.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. There's not any doubt about that at all. Such a good movie. So that's what I wanted to go there at least and talk about a particular one that I thought actually did a decent job of doing something different.
Exorcist 2, The Heretic, it's a fun movie to riff on. I'll admit that. But that's the best thing I can say about it.
Well, it's one of those things where it just doesn't work. But you got to marvel at the absolute, you know, audacity of the film. Because it's fucking nuts.
I read somewhere that Burton was constantly drunk on the set.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. No question that man was drunk on set. You know,
he probably had to drink just to get through it.
Yeah.
Now, John, I've only seen two Don Vorman movies, and that's Deliverance and Excalibur. He's a good director, This is just one of these things where you're like, what were you thinking?
Oh, listen, let me tell you something. There's something about John Borman you should know. When that man goes off the rails, it's one of the most beautiful things in the world. I have one word for you. Zardoz.
Oh, he did Zardoz?
Oh, absolutely.
I freaking love Zardoz.
Yeah. When he goes off the rails, he goes off the rails. He did Point Blank. He did, there's a wonderful film called The General, which is a great gangster movie with Brendan Gleeson. I really like Borman as a director. The Emerald Forest, he's always entertaining and always off the beaten track. So I like Exorcist 2. I always have. But if you're going to watch Exorcist 2, you need to watch the, I think it's the director's cut, but it's the third cut, where both Kitty Wynn and Richard Burton die. Okay? That's the one to watch.
Yeah, I guess the one I saw was the theatrical cut, the one that was playing on HBO.
Right. Right, which is, you know, it's one of those things where it's just, okay, that's what it is. It's a little weird. We'll work with it.
Well, you got me curious now. I just might have to hunt down the director's cut.
Yeah, that's the one I would recommend, for sure.
Well,
where do you want to go from here?
Well, since we're talking about franchises that have multiple movies in it that are doing something right, I have to go with one. And a lot of people are going to disagree with me, and that's fine, because, you know, to each their own. And that is Leprechaun.
Okay. All righty then.
I told you earlier that I had seen all of them. I made a mistake. I haven't seen the newer ones. But I have seen the rest of them. And here's the thing. Yeah, they keep changing it up. But basically what it is, it's like, you've got Michael Myers, you've got Jason Voorhees, you've got Freddy Krueger, you've got Chucky, you've got the tall man from Phantasm. All of these people have a name or some kind of moniker. Okay, this is just the Leprechaun. And while it is played by the same actor, it's set up to where he could be playing a different Leprechaun each time. Therefore, there doesn't have to be continuity. In the first one, he's looking for his gold. In the second one, he falls in love with a girl and is trying to make her his bride, and her friends, of course, are trying to stop him. And then the third one, he goes to Vegas. And that one is freaking hilarious. The fourth one, he goes to the hood. And just seeing him interact with Ice-T is hilarious, freaking hilarious. In the fifth one, he's in space. And a lot of people say they jump the shark when they go into space, but I disagree on this one. This one is absolutely freaking hilarious. And then he goes back to the hood on the sixth one. Now, I haven't seen any of the others after that. I've heard they're not very good, but then a lot of people don't think that, you know, the Leprechaun movies are very good in general, but I happen to really enjoy them. This is an example of it doing right, because you're taking the character, the Leprechaun, only except instead of making him the Leprechaun, you're making him a Leprechaun. So this way, you can stick him in a bunch of different situations and not have to worry about continuity, not having to worry about lather, rinse, repeat. And I love it. I could have a marathon of those movies and watch them all damn day. I love them that much.
Okay, so the question I have is, you know, considering most people don't care for the films, do you consider them your guilty pleasure, or do you think they're actually, you know, more than that?
Well, let me clarify something before I go into it. I don't have guilty pleasures. I do not feel guilty about anything I enjoy. And if I go against the status quo, that's okay. If you want to talk about bad movies, I mean, if you're talking about it being bad, I don't really think they're bad, because even later on, they are not poorly made. And as far as acting is concerned, everybody involved, they don't take themselves seriously. This is a franchise where you don't take yourself seriously. I don't care what role you're playing. Everybody does the best that they can do, and they have a great time with it. So, yeah, I do think, you know, even if I had a guilty pleasure, I think there's so much more. And, you know, there are people that generally don't like them, and that's fine, but I think there's a lot of people who are kind of snobbish towards them.
Right. I understand that. You know, we all have franchises like that for me. I mean, you know, you mentioned it, and when it's time, I'll get to it. But why don't you finish up with Leprechaun?
I was finished.
Okay, then I can move on, and I can just say, Phantasm. Okay, I love Phantasm, and even the worst of the films, I love. And there's something very special to these films. Now, back when this came in at 1979, I was 21 years old, and Halloween had just come out again, and then Phantasm. And I thought those two films were just so much on the cutting edge for horror. And particularly Phantasm, because you have this very unique character, the tall man. You have a story that makes no sense. And it's like the whole movie is a dream, you know, with opium pipes. Seriously. And the whole thing about it was just so unique. And, of course, it was directed by a very young gentleman by the name of Don Coscarelli. And Don has turned out to be one of the more interesting characters in genre films. I really like him as a director. But each one of them, I think, has its charms. Now, unfortunately, I do think that we get into franchise fatigue here. But the first one was done with little money. And then you get into the second one, which was really pushed by the studio. A lot more money. To this day, it's the biggest film budget that Don Coscarelli ever had. And I just think it was a bit of overkill, as they always do. You know, the sequel, they want more flying balls, they want more this, they want more that. And that's what happened with the second one. But as you get on to 3, 4, and 5, the budgets get much less, and particularly 5, where basically they had no budget at all, but he still wanted to do a film because Angus was dying. But they get more weird, which is kind of odd for me to say that with Phantasm. But they get more unusual and going into different aspects of the whole world and that. And I like it a lot. I like them a lot. So what are your thoughts on that series?
I cannot comment because I've only seen the first one, and I wasn't really a big fan of it.
So I think the question is, why would that be? Why weren't you a fan?
Well, I can't really explain it. But I think the main problem I had with it was our protagonist, Mike. He was an annoying little shit.
Well, it was the 70s. You know, it was still that decade of anti-heroes and assholes as protagonists. That's one of the main things about the 70s. And it's very true. You're absolutely right. The kids are a complete asshole.
But
agree
no
with
you 100%. No wonder Jody wanted to send him off to their aunts.
You know, the complaint I always heard about Phantasm is it makes no sense.
Well, see,
I don't get it.
That's not necessarily a detraction for me.
I've watched
a lot of movies that I didn't get, but yet I enjoyed the ride. And then there are movies that I've understood perfectly that I hated. I know this sounds ridiculous, Carl, but I can't explain it. I just kept sitting there, and I had no distractions when I watched it. I mean, I paid attention to it. I've actually watched it twice. The first time was when I was younger, and then I watched it again, I think, last year, trying very hard to see what people love so much about it. And I just don't get it. I mean, I don't know. I was kind of bored, and I didn't really see what was so special about it. You know, if people love it, great. You know, it's really wasn't my cup of tea. I might give it another watch and try the sequels, but you know, it wasn't for me.
That's understandable. You know, that's certainly true of me and Friday the 13th series. I mean, yeah. Yeah, so you know, that's all individual taste. So what's our next franchise we want to talk about?
Oh, the next one is Nightmare on Elm Street. I have such a love hate with it.
Okay,
you know,
let's talk about it.
It started out really good, you know, and it's slightly different than your other slashers because, you know, Freddy is supernatural. He's a child murderer that was lynched by the neighborhood parents and burnt to death, and he comes back and haunts the teenagers' dreams, the children of the people who killed him. Basically, he kills you in your sleep. So, basically, we have it's the same formula as Friday the 13th. Basically, he's vanquished, and then he comes back. Now, the second one did something a little different. And the first time I saw it, something seemed a little off to me, and I couldn't figure out what it was. So years later, when I watched it again, I picked up on it. There is a reason why they call it the gay sequel. Basically, instead of having a final girl, you have Jesse, the final guy. And Freddy is trying to take over Jesse's body, which could be kind of sexual if you want to look at it that way. Also, Jesse has a girlfriend that he's not interested in. He appears to be more interested in his best friend, than her. And there's just all these things that I never picked up on when I saw it the first time. That, I mean, even before the articles came out and Mike Patton, the guy who played Jesse, talked about how he was dealing with his own sexuality at that time. Even before all that, I heard about all that. I picked up on it the second time I watched it. So, yeah, they did something different. The third and fourth ones.
Let me interrupt because talking about number two is we had a wonderful podcast with the director of number two, okay, which is Jack Shoulder. And this was when I was partnering with Stephen Ronquillo. And this was actually for Martin Landau's death. But we talked about number two, and the writers were gay. The director's gay. The star is gay. Of course it's gay. And they knew it. Of course, they're not going to push that. But everybody, you know, knew it. And it's a really odd doc to have this gay sequel as a gay sequel that nobody acknowledges at the time that it was a gay sequel. But the LGBT community at the time knew it. Trust me.
Oh, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they picked up on everything Jesse was going through, on all the innuendos, which once you look back at it, really aren't innuendos. I'm sure they picked up on it because it probably mirrored their own experience. Well, okay. Except for having a demon trying to take over your own body, but everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, so anyway, keep going. You were going to go three and four. I just had to interrupt there for a moment.
That's okay. I should have given you a break to hear your thoughts on it. Well, three and four are your basic standards. I really don't want to go over the plots. You can look them up if you're interested. But it's your basic, yeah, your teenagers. They die in their dreams and yada, yada. Freddy keeps getting, resurrected. The best thing about the Dream Warriors, in my opinion, was, well, the music. The Dream Warriors theme by Dawkins. But other than that, it's just basically lather, rinse, repeat. And in the beginning, Freddy is freaking scary. He is. He's scary. And he did do some one-liners, but they weren't intrusive. All throughout the rest of the movie, he becomes a clown. And they try to do something different in the next to the last one by giving his backstory and having a secret daughter that no one knew about. And it didn't, to me, it didn't help. It really didn't help. In fact, in my horror film groups, a lot of these people talk about Freddy's Dead being their least favorite of the franchise. And I can honestly see why. So then Wes Craven decides to do something different and kind of like retcon everything and make it meta. Make it to where, on the new Nightmare, make it to where, they're all movies. They're all movies. However, the dream demons are real. So then the dream demons come and they take over and then Freddy becomes real and he's trying to possess Nancy's child, or actually Heather Thompson's child. It gets really, really convoluted. And then, of course, we have our Freddy versus Jason, which was a fun time, but really nothing special. Now, the remake, I did enjoy the remake, and I know I'm in the minority, but I really enjoyed the remake. I thought Jackie Earle Haley did awesome as Freddie, and he brought him back to his nastiness. Freddie actually became scary again.
That actually is the best thing about the remake. I do happen to agree with you on that. And I thought Jackie Earle Haley did a good job, but I don't think it was scripted well. I don't think the script was good. I really don't. I think they tried to explain too much. And that's my opinion. You know, that doesn't mean I'm right. But that's the way I talk.
Opinions are not right or wrong.
That's true. So my thoughts on it is that basically Nightmare on Elm Street is only worth it when Wes Craven's involved. And that would be 1, 3, and 6. Otherwise, it's a mess. And I do have a special spot in my heart for number 2, okay, for Jack Shoulders film. I still don't think it's a good film. But nonetheless,
first,
I still have a...
The first and second one were the best, in my opinion.
Yeah. I love 3. I love Dream Wars. I seriously do. I think that cast is amazing. I think Heather Langenkamp becomes a real hero, and she really does a great job. I think it's a really good... I think the quips... I love the TV setup. I love the Dick Cavett. I think it's really good and really witty, and it's a complete different take on it. And 6, which is the meta version.
I do like number 3. I do like number 3. It's from number 3 on up, it starts to repeat the pattern again.
Right. You know,
Welcome to prime time, bitch.
I love it. I love it. And the other thing, too, is I really like 6. I went to see that with a friend of mine, Mike Grady. And Mike didn't know the series that well. And he walked out of that and he said, "Oh, my God, I think I saw the future of horror movies there." And in many ways, he was right. Because, you know, then Scream happened, okay? And the meta approach really, really changed things. And it's all because of Nightmare 6, New Nightmare. So anyway, that's my thoughts on the Nightmare series.
So do you have any other franchises you want to talk about?
Well, yeah, I do. Let's go into Silent Night, Deadly Night. Okay? Which, to be honest, I can't stand until we get to 3, 4, and 5. Okay, now, Silent Night, Deadly Night is basically a remake of a section of Tales from the Crypt. Okay, so it's Christmas night. A psychotic Santa escapes from the loony bin and kills Joan Collins, while her son, you know, and Joan Collins has killed somebody beforehand, so she deserves it. But so anyway, that's the deal on that. And so you've got Silent Night, Deadly Night as this sort of like remake of that section, and it's not well done. And number 2 is not well done. But number
Garbage
3.
Day.
Well, okay. Yeah, but whatever. Whatever. But number 3 starts. So there's a director I love. His name is Monty Hellman. Monty Hellman gave us the shooting and Rod the World one. He's done so many wonderful things. He did a two-lane blacktop. But he's not getting hired as a director because he's too out there. So, let's get Monty Hellman to direct number three, and we'll get a psychic connection in that, and we'll do this movie. And Hellman, you either love this movie or you hate it. If you like the first two, you're going to hate number three, four, and five. If you hate the first two, you're going to love the next three because they just go out there. And so basically you have this war movie that turns into a very, very much a psychodrama. Okay? And I think there are only two killings in the whole movie. So most of it is talk. I find it really interesting, and people find the movie extremely boring. Critical reception was terrible, but over the years it's gotten more and more of a cadre of respect. But you get into number four, which is okay, but Monty Hellman's not involved. But it's decent. But number five, which was not supposed to be a Silent Night, Deadly Night, we haven't talked about this yet, where there's a movie that's made, let's put it in here and we'll just add a scene and we'll make it a killer Santa Claus movie. Well, The Toy Maker was actually directed by Hellman again, along with somebody else, and co-written by him. And it has Mickey Rooney as this demented toy maker. Now, Mickey Rooney, you think of him with Judy Garland and so on and so forth. Check some of his later shit out. Because that man went nuts. There's C.J. Lang Presents. There's a number of films that he did that are just out there. And this is one of them. And I know you've seen The Toy Maker. So what's your thought on The Toy Maker? Is it like nuts or what?
It is nuts. I actually liked The Toy Maker.
Oh, I love it. I absolutely love that film. Truly do.
Scared the crap out of me, but that's what it was supposed to do.
Yeah,
which I found. Well, the first time I saw the first Silent Night, Deadly Night, I found it scary. Previous viewings, not so much. Now I do enjoy the first one. Is it a good movie in the sense that is it well made? Not really, no. But I enjoy it. It's entertaining for me. Second one I didn't care for. Third one I didn't care for. Sorry, Carl. The fourth one.
Okay, but you do acknowledge that it was something different, right?
Yeah, it was something different. What's the fourth one, The Initiation? I didn't see that one.
Yeah, fourth one was The Initiation, which I didn't really care for, but it's not horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't see that one. I've heard about it. The Toy Maker, I was like, oh my God, this is freaking good, and I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight.
it's wonderful. And again, it all falls on Mickey Rooney. The reason that works, it's Mickey Rooney. And it works so well.
Yeah, and when you have a toy maker named Joe Petto, and he has a son named Pino, you know where this is going.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a whole demented take on Pinocchio. And it's wonderful. It really is. It's a great little movie. Great little movie. And one I recommend highly.
Did you see the remake of the first one? Well, semi-remake called Silent Night?
No.
Oh, Carl, I think you would like that one so much better than the original Silent Night, Deadly Night. It's not campy at all. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with camp when done right, but, I mean, it's a more serious take on it. It's got really, really good acting, good writing. It's got Malcolm McDowell playing a grumpy, arrogant
character. I've been wanting to see that because I'm a Malcolm McDowell fanatic, but I've never seen it.
All I had to do was say his name, and you're on board.
Well, I love Malcolm. Truly love Malcolm McDowell.
It's also got Donald Logue as a foul-mouthed mall Santa. I love Donald Logue, and he is freaking hilarious in this movie.
Oh, good. Good. Well, that sounds good.
I really do think you would enjoy it. Even if you don't like the original Silent Night, Deadly Night, you'll probably like this one.
Oh, I would watch it. There's no doubt about it. I would watch it. None. No? So anyway, where do you want to go from here, my dear?
Well, I was going to talk about Chucky, but then I really don't have that much to say about Chucky. I didn't hate, well, I didn't really care for the second and the third sequel. I kind of like the direction that it's going now, but at the same time, it's, I don't know, it might be going off the rails. I think I'm going to wait and give my opinion on the TV show when it comes out.
Okay.
There's going to be, in 2021, or 2022, it was going to be 2021, but it's been pushed back because of COVID. But on US, it's supposed to debut on USA and Sci-Fi in 2022. And Brad Dourif will be doing the voice of Chucky. The series that I do want to talk about, though, is Hellraiser.
Okay, can I interrupt for just a moment? Because I want to just go and tell you a Chucky story.
Okay.
So I do like The Seed of Chucky and The Bride of Chucky. Now, Don Mancini decided to go completely nuts, you know, comedy. And so I'm sitting in the theater going to watch Seed of Chucky. And this woman comes in with her 7-year-old son.
Oh, my God.
Okay, the movie is an R-rated film. Okay. And I look at her like, do you know what you're walking into? And she says, well, my son loves Chucky. And so we're going to see. Well, if you remember Seed of Chucky, the first 5 minutes, there's a scene in silhouette of Chucky masturbating.
Yes.
Yes. And she, like, grabs him and starts running out of the theater. And like, I told you. You didn't listen to me. Seriously. So that's my Chucky story.
I do think it's hysterical that it didn't seem to work when he was looking at Playboy, but when he found the Fangoria cover with Melinda Clark in Return of Living Dead 3 with all the glass stuck in her, that did the job.
Well, you know, you do know about Rule 34, right?
Do you know about
you know
what
Rule 34 is?
No, I don't.
You know, somebody, whatever it is, somebody's going to masturbate to it. Don't care what it is. Somebody's going to masturbate.
Unfortunately, that does not surprise me.
Yep.
I watched a movie called Crash. Now, not the one about racism, but the David Cronenberg one about car crash fetish.
Oh, man. That's a rough one.
Watching this, going, okay, if this is not a fetish already, it's going to be now.
Oh, it's a fetish. It was already a fetish, trust me.
Yeah, it was based on a novel. So.
Yeah, by J.G. Ballard, which I read several of his novels. I love Ballard. And it's a very, very satirical work. And what Cronenberg did is he I won't say he upped the ante in far as his sexuality, but he does it in such a cold, clinical way that it's yucky. He doesn't glamorize it at all.
I didn't find it erotic at all.
No, and nor is that his, nor does he want you to find it erotic. He wants you to look at it with clinical eyes, and there are reasons for that. But anyway, you were about to say?
Hellraiser. Okay, almost anyone who knows me knows that I am a huge Hellraiser fan. Well, only 1 through 3, okay? 1 through 3, you might say that they were kind of repetitive, but they had, I mean, in the sense that, you know, someone calls the Cenobites and they come and mass destruction ensues, but they were, each one was a little bit different. And to be fair, the fourth one was different too. It was just not executed very well. It took place. It had a good idea. It took place in 3 different timelines, and it was about one segment was about the making of the Lamont configuration, how it was constructed, and it basically takes place in 3 different timelines. The last 2 stories are concerning descendants of the creator of the box. And it had good intentions, but it was all over the place. The best thing about number 4 was the Cenobite, Angelique. She was different than the others in that while the others were humans who became Cenobites, she was a Cenobite who became human. Basically, they did some kind of ritual where they killed a prostitute, and she basically inhabited this body. And then towards the end of the movie, she looks like a Cenobite. But until then, she looked human. And to me, she was the best thing about it. I mean, you want to talk about a villainess you love to hate? And she was very charismatic. The actress, I don't remember her name, unfortunately, but the actress who played her was beautiful, and she did a great job. Angelique was very charismatic. She was the best thing about it. And the fourth one took place in space. Now, as you could probably tell, like from my previous talks about Jason X and Leprechaun in Space, when they put them in space, that does not necessarily mean, to me anyway, that they're jumping the shark. However, this time they jumped the shark. It didn't work. And here's the thing. It had like 3 different directors, 3 or 4. One of them was actually Kevin Yeager, the guy who did the special effects on the Chucky movies. Anyway, each one of them had their name taped off, so it was an infamous Alan Smithy film. Most people who are familiar with Alan Smithy know that when they see that name, it doesn't bode well. For those who are not familiar, Alan Snibby is a pseudonym come up by the screen that the screenwriter the
Director's
screen,
Guild. Director's Guild.
Director's Guild. That's what I'm trying to say. The Director's Guild came up with whenever someone wants their name taken off a film. So basically, if you see, now I don't think they use it anymore. But,
no, they don't. It's been retired.
If you see something directed by, something from the past that's been directed by Alan Smithy, that's not a good sign. Basically, it had a very very troubled production history, and it shows. Now, the rest of these films, I have seen them all except for the latest one, Judgment, and I'm not really all that interested in seeing it, but I probably will. Basically, most of them, except for maybe Revelations, but it still wasn't very good. Most of them, it's basically like, okay, we have a script. Now let's see how we can put Pinhead in it. And you can tell those ones because Pinhead appears very intermittently. And he doesn't really seem to have any effect on what's going on. It's like how the later Hammer Dracula films were. It's like we have a script, can we put Dracula in it? And it reeks of desperation. I'm sitting here going, okay, here's the thing, Carl. These movies have potential. It's like you could have tried to do something and with them as they are and not put Pinhead in. But for some reason, they had to try to put Pinhead. And, of course, by this time, Clive Barker has washed his hands of of the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Rumor has it he's trying to get a reboot going that he will be personally involved in, and that I am looking forward to.
Yeah, and again, I think what you need to look at is the original film, who's behind it? And, of course, the original film was Clive Barker. None of the sequels was Barker involved in. None. I'll repeat that. None. So I'm not saying they won't have a good film here and there. But you know, this whole thing about fatigue, and remember that's what we're talking about. That's exactly the definition. The studio wants to have a cash cow or, you know, to have a direct-to-video DTV series. And I don't know how many of those they did with Pumpkinhead. They did it with so many. You know, it's scary. It really is.
Yeah. It's like, and here's the thing that kind of bothers me, and I really cannot judge because I have been guilty of it myself in the past. People are always crying out that there's no original idea, especially horror fans. There's no original ideas anymore. There's no original horror. Yet when an original horror comes out, they won't support it. Instead, they'll go see Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm Street 5000, and then they'll turn around and they'll start claiming there's no original horror again. And now, I'm not saying every horror film, but, you know, as reading all the articles in the magazines and online and being a member of three horror groups, this is what I hear. This is what I see constantly. There's no good original horror. There's no good original horror. There's too many remakes. There's too many sequels. Well, why is that? Because it's a business. It's a money-making business. And they're going to make, I mean, granted, you do have filmmakers like Ari Aster and who did Hereditary and Midsommar, and Robert Eggers, who did The Witch and The Lighthouse. You do have people like that who are going to make the films that they want to make. And you've got studios like A24 backing them. He's going to give them the freedom to make the kind of films they want to make, you know, that aren't cash cows, but however are successful. But most of the time, it's like you want to do what makes money. And what makes money? Remakes, reboots, sequels. They make money. So if you want more original films, support original films. And if you can't find them in the theater, go to Redbox. Go to your local, like, Walmart. They still sell movies. Go online and to streaming sites. There are lots of really good movies that don't make it to the theaters.
Well, I also think at this point that we need to do a shout-out to our prospective groups. Because personally, if you're looking for horror movies, the group that you co-admin is one of the best out there. So why don't you talk about that, and then I'm going to talk about ISF for a moment.
Oh, yes. I am a moderator in a group on Facebook called Horror Films, and the administrator, Brian Harris, he is always good about not only bringing attention to films that are coming out, but also anytime there's going to be a DVD or Blu-ray release of an older film, he posts about that. We've always got people in the group talking about either new films that aren't in the theater or older films that don't get a whole lot of attention. And I'm also a member of a Facebook group called Killer Six, and it's the same thing there, too. You've got people talking about new horror, different older horror that doesn't get much attention. So, yeah, it's if you want to learn more, go to Facebook and join the group.
You'll absolutely
learn a lot.
Oh, yeah. And I got to do a shout-out to ISF. Now, of course, we do the ISF podcast. And when I say ISF, I mean Incredible Strange Films. We are a film group that is an entry point. And it's not just for anything that's strange. You know, and we have over 275,000 members in our group. I want you to think about that for a moment. The amount of material that comes through, we get 400 to 500 pending posts a day. So if you just scroll through, you're going to find stuff you've never heard. And the other thing, too, is I'm now doing a series of podcasts in conjunction with them. And we talk to directors and that of very oddball films. And one I really want to talk about, I just had a wonderful second interview with him on Friday, and we talked about cinematic heavens and hells and purgatories. It's Joe Bagod. And Joe did a film just put out, and it's now in the festival circuit. And you can watch it online at any of these festivals. And if you go to sistertempest.com, or look at Sister Tempest on Facebook, you'll see it. But I'm going to tell you the name. It is a sci-fi, horror, comedy, religious, what the fuck. And that's exactly what it is. And it is one of the most unique films you've ever seen. And I had the privilege of watching it. There's really good stuff out there, and we do recommend very, very highly that you do. And the other thing too is with Brian Harris and Tony Strauss and Tim Paxton and all the people at WK Books, they put out some of the best books on genre out there, and we want to give them a nice shout out too. So there, I'm done plugging. Okay. Done plugging. Done.
Well, it's like I was saying, if you want original horror, then support original horror. If you don't want a ton of remakes and sequels, don't support them. As a matter of fact, the thing about remakes that really irritates me is that people will complain about them, but then they will go see them just so they can complain more about them.
Right.
And, you know, you're telling these people, you're telling the filmmakers, you're telling the producers, the studios, with your money, that that's what you want to see, even though you claim you really don't want to see them. Me personally, I mean, it's one thing to review a movie for the show or for Wings Chop or something like that. It's totally different to pay money to go see a movie that I really don't want to see just so I can complain about it. It's a waste of time and money, and I won't do it.
Mm-hmm. No, and I agree with you on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's stuff out there. You just have to dig, and you have to know how to dig. And you've got so much availability now with the web and everything else. You know, why, you know, you shouldn't be complaining. Because it can be found, trust me.
It's not going to fall in your lap, people.
No, but there are ways to find it, trust me. No question about that.
Yeah. So, do you have any more franchises you want to talk about?
Well, you know, we talked a little bit about Dracula and the Universal and Hammer, but I think those should be their own shows because there's just so much.
Definitely. That's why I touched on it briefly.
Right. And the other thing, too, is also Fast and Furious, which what they've done basically is they've turned them into James Bond movies. Which is okay. You know, I'm not a huge fan, but I will say this. I'm one of all those films, the one that I like more than any of the others is Tokyo Drift. And there's a reason for that. Because of Takeshi Kitano's in it. And I love him. Absolutely friggin' love him. But that's me, you know, so there you go. I mean, there's so much out there and I mean, you know, we were just touching on horror stuff. So, all right. So you want to finish it up? And
I've only seen the first Fast and Furious and Hobbs and Shaw. And I did like the first one, but I hysterically loved Hobbs and Shaw.
Oh, yeah. I'd agree with that.
I mean, that was the chemistry between Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham is just, it's perfect. It's perfect.
Oh, yeah. And I love Statham. I adore that man. I love him dearly. You know, so anyway, what can I tell you?
Do you have anything else to add, Carl?
Well, actually, let's talk about what's coming up in the week. So, on Tuesday, for our next ISF podcast, We're going to have ISF members Greg Espinoza and Craig Ahrens, and they teamed together and they produced a film and co-wrote a film called The Evil at the End of the Street, which is now on Tubi and Amazon Prime. So you should go and watch it, people. Seriously, you should definitely watch that movie. And we'll be talking about that and their new things that they'll be doing because they're now shooting another film. But we'll be talking to them. And then on Friday, Adam is going to be doing the films of the Coen brothers. And then what do you have on next Sunday? What's your show next Sunday? Do you know?
Next Sunday, we are going to talk about social commentary in film. Where is the line between commentary and propaganda?
Okay. All right. That's a good one. That's a good one. And I'll be looking for that. I'm looking forward to that. Let's see. What else can I do? That's all we got, basically. So, if there isn't anything else, we could call it a night. And so why don't you give us our outro here?
Da, 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 da. Oh, sorry.
No, you're not, and I'm okay with that.
All right, I'll stop. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and fur babies, for joining us tonight. And we appreciate your listenership. And I hope y'all have a great week. And I will see you next week, my pets. Bye.
Bye. And Danae, before we go, I just want to say that this was a wonderful first episode of The Dungeon, and may there be many, many, many more. All right?
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it, and I did this totally script-free, so.
There you go. I'm so proud of you.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
All right, folks. Say goodnight.
Good night.
Good night.